Untangling Pandas and Pans is a podcast about two little-known medical disorders characterized by the sudden and dramatic onset of symptoms such as obsessions and compulsions, vocal or motor tics, and restricted eating behaviors, and a whole host of other symptoms following a strep or other bacterial or viral infection. I have the privilege of interviewing some of the top researchers and clinicians in this rapidly growing area, known by various names such as immune-mediated neuropsychiatric disorders, infection-associated neuroimmune disorders, and autoimmune encephalitis, or simply PANDAS and PANS. My name is Dr. Susan Manful. I am a social psychologist, the executive director of the Alex Manful Fund, and the mother of Alex Manful, who died at 26 years old due to PANDAS, a disorder my husband and I knew next to nothing about, certainly not that our daughter could die from it.
This is episode 2 of Untangling PANDAS and PANS, recorded April 25th, 2024.
I feel very fortunate to have two exceptionally interesting guests with us today. A highly respected psychiatrist who is an expert in an emerging field called neuroimmune psychiatry and whose research focuses on PANDAS, PANS, OCD, and Tourette syndrome. And a technology expert who lives and works in Southern California, who's in his mid-50s, and for 33 years managed to live with intractable OCD. That OCD drastically changed the course of his life. His OCD was stubbornly unresponsive to a wide range of gold standard treatments until, as he puts it, he won the lottery, and his life changed in ways he had no longer thought were possible. I am so pleased to welcome Dr. Kyle Williams, founder and director of the Pediatric Neuropsychiatry and Immunology Program at Massachusetts General Hospital, instructor in psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School, and researcher on the disorders that I just mentioned. He also has a private practice. He is an original member of the first PANS Consensus Conference in spring of 2013 at Stanford University. That evolved into the PANS Consortium that still meets regularly today to try and advance understanding of PANDAS and PANS. And finally, he is a member of the Massachusetts PANDAS PANS Advisory Council. Our other guest is Andrew, whose first name will suffice in order to preserve his privacy. Andrew's story was instrumental in inspiring Dr. Williams' very exciting research project that is supported by the Alex Manful Fund and entitled Investigating the Link Between Autoimmunity and Psychiatric Disorders, A Search for Novel Therapeutic Targets. Their connection reminds me of those that Amy Doxer Marcus writes about in her new book, We, the Scientists, How a Daring Team of Parents and Doctors Forged a New Path for Medicine. We will talk about both Andrew's story and Dr. Williams' research. Let's get started. So, Andrew, let me start with you. We are brought here together today primarily because you sent an email to Dr. Williams about 2 years ago, no, in 2021. So let's begin with what prompted you to write to Dr. Williams.
Sure. So about 5 years ago, I have, you know, psoriatic arthritis. Well, I've had psoriasis most of my life, among other things. And the psoriasis converted into psoriatic arthritis. And, you know, I had been able to manage the skin, the plaque psoriasis pretty well for a number of years. And then when my joints started to be impacted, I was concerned about losing mobility. There were a lot of, it was fairly alarming. And I went to see the dermatologist first, and then I was quickly placed on a biologic treatment called Cosentyx. And it was specifically for the psoriasis and the inflammation related to the psoriatic arthritis. And after, you know, the initial 3 months, that the psoriasis that I've been dealing with all my life cleared up. It was really remarkable. And all the inflammation related to the psoriatic arthritis resolved itself as well. And then another thing happened that was very surprising, and I had never even considered that I, you know, also, you know, throughout my life struggled with OCD and, you know, obsessional thoughts and the compulsivity related to that, that I'd been able to manage as well, started to abate and then ultimately resolved. And it was, you know, it was the tail end of a 33-year story, an odyssey, if you will. And it was really, I'd never really put, you know, a number of these elements together. And so it was a very surprising, very, very exciting event for many reasons. And I started, you know, looking online. And as finally I connected, you know, a number of dots that hadn't been connected for decades. And I was looking in the area of OCD, psoriasis or autoimmune disease, as well as strep, which, you know, I had strep throat, you know, regularly as a kid. And I quickly found myself reading Dr. Williams's bio. And I was like, oh, I got to reach out to this guy. Because I just, you know, because it was still kind of a, it was definitely a long shot that I had, you know, brought these things together and that I wanted to find some sort of confirmation. Additionally, I was like, wow, if this is true, people need to know about this. And so I wrote a very, very concise, specific email to Dr. Williams, really not expecting a response. Dr. Williams responded within a couple of days, and I was completely floored and excited. And that within itself was very, very validating.
So, Dr. Williams, you are a very busy man. What spoke to you in Andrew's email to you?
You know, a lot of things were really interesting in the way that Andrew described a story. And, you know, and some of them were familiar in the sense that, you know, Andrew, in the original email that you sent to me, you talked about how your psoriasis also had started after a strep infection early on, that it was, which is a known complication of strep infection for some people, is that it actually results in a condition called guttate psoriasis. And so, in this sense, it's a type of psoriasis that is stimulated by the infection and develops for some still unknown reason in some people following a strep infection. And so that piece was familiar kind of to the work that I do and the patients that I've treated about how, okay, here's a strep infection and here is a consequence following the strep infection. And one of the consequences that you know, obviously I focus on a lot is the development of obsessive compulsive symptoms after the strep infection. But for Andrew, what you were saying in your email originally too, is that kind of both of these things seem to happen in concert after the strep infection, and that there was guttate psoriasis and then also kind of the onset of OCD.
Right.
And tell me if I'm making sure I'm getting that right. That and
it's true. And if I can add some color to that, so mm-hmm. You know, as a child, I had, you know, very substantial tonsils, and I annually had strep throat,
mm-hmm.
and that I, you know, I recovered well, but it, you know, there were definitely times after the infections were a little wobbly, say the least. And when I reflect on it, that I was exhibiting, you know, some initial symptoms of, you know, obsessional thoughts, but it would abate. But I certainly, you know, developed psoriasis thereafter, and that continued on. The, you know, really I wasn't impaired by, you know, these events until I was about 17, and I had a very pronounced response to a strep infection in my freshman year in college. And that's when the obsessional thoughts and ruminations pretty much, you know, became the, they it was an, I was impaired. That was the sort of overriding internal experience that, that got in the way of many things, namely school.
Yeah. And
we'll come back to that because I'd like to hear the details of that. Kyle, was there anything else that caught your attention?
Yeah, it was the description of how things got better after you started Cosentyx. And there were a couple of things in that that really were, you know, I'm still fascinated by, but really caught me in the email. One of which is just that I'm always interested in hearing what has made OCD 10 folks better for people. You know, we think we have a general sense of treatments that are helpful for people with obsessive compulsive disorder. And for a lot of people, they work relatively well. You know, cognitive behavioral therapy is one that can be helpful for many people and has been helpful. Medication, you know, SSRIs like Prozac and Lexapro have been helpful for people. But then there's a well-recognized group of people that don't respond to either one, or the response that they have to both therapies or either therapy is just not adequate. People are, you know, despite taking medication or doing cognitive behavioral therapy, there are still some people that just don't have full sort of relief or benefit from OCD symptoms. And then again, this other category of, you know, roughly about 30% of people who sometimes just do not respond to either therapy. And the treatment for individuals who are not responding to those therapies is less kind of based, less of a protocol, less of a known approach. We start to sort of try other, you know, therapies, adjunctive medication. But to hear a story about someone who had a really rapid and significant relief based on an immune-based treatment is something that really still, you know, it's been a focus of mine for a while, but still fascinating because Cosentyx is a medication, and we'll talk about this, I'm sure, as we go on in detail too, but it really does one specific thing where it's working on one specific component of the immune system. And that working on, you know, that component of the immune system certainly has a number of downstream effects, but the sort of mechanism of action of Cosentyx is pretty singular in what it works on. And if that was able to be involved in both the benefit that you saw to psoriasis and to psoriatic arthritis, as well as OCD, it's fascinating. And it really, I think, is something that, you know, similar to Andrew, what you're saying about if this is true, you know, if this is a sort of, I mean, we know it's true, but if these things are linked, then I'm probably not the only one who, you know, like we've got to get this out there because this story may be replicated in other people that we're just not hearing about right now. And that, I think, it really is what catches me too.
Yeah, and that was certainly my motivation. Part of my motivation to reach out to you, because the entire sort of constellation of symptoms that I had for, you know, over three decades, that they left as quickly as they came.
Yeah.
And it was very, very remarkable. So a common sense, this is, you know, I'm certainly not a scientist or a physician, but a common sense approach to this, that you look at that result and you say, this must be a very targeted solution. And there must be a pretty discrete problem. And I had been, you know, looking at it, you know, the symptoms, because there weren't any sort of core tests or what have you that you could, you know, go to a physician and find out for certain that you had a specific diagnosis. So I had a very sort of compartmentalized approach to things. So eventually I had my tonsils out, so that made the strep throat significantly less frequent. In terms of psoriasis, there are topical therapeutics that I used, as well as moving to California to get in the sun. And with regard to the OCD, there was nothing I could do. I tried everything. Every imaginable, therapeutic approach, whether it was, pharmacology or whether it was, cognitive behavioral therapy, and the themes would change, but the intensity of it did not.
You said that you had yearly bouts of strep from childhood.
Yes.
I think in our conversation that you said that you also had some mild OCD during childhood.
Yeah, particularly after the, usually it was usually around Christmas every year where I would, I'd get strep throat. It was kind of, you could set your clock to it. Mm-hmm. And I had a very high fever. It was, it was pretty intense. And then after the infection sort of abated, that I, found myself, counting tiles on the floor, or I would look at a shampoo bottle and count all the letters, all the vowels. And I had to. It was this, something was compelling me to do this. And I'd have sort of these, repetitious phrases in my head that were, would loop for, a number of weeks, and then this stuff would sort of pass. And I didn't really pay too much attention to it. And, the communication to me about the strep was just, this was going to pass, that this is part of your childhood. You get ear infections, you get strep. And then, once go through this rite of passage, it's behind you. So I didn't, and I was fine afterwards. So I didn't really pay too much attention to it. And then there was my freshman year and in college, and I literally woke up one morning and was dysfunctional. I grew up in an environment where there was a great focus on being able to learn how to do things, and anywhere from, I don't recall a time where I wasn't able to read or wasn't able to swim or wasn't able to ice skate. And then I had a lot of competence in the world, So for example, if it was cold in the house, it was Chester County, Pennsylvania, that my mother would encourage us to build a fire. And so I was quite adept at chopping wood and so forth. And when I was pestering her in the kitchen, she would show me how to use a knife. And literally one morning in 1986, I woke up and I was fearful of using knives or being close to anything sharp. And I had this thought in my head that that I would either harm myself or harm somebody else. And I was stuck in this state of doubt. And, this was, I had nothing even close to this before. And it affected my ability to concentrate, to read, to function. And I'd never had anything interfere with that ever. Additionally, one of the things that was really noteworthy and strange was that I was smelling things that weren't there. I smell like cut grass or like a Thanksgiving turkey or burning plastic, and I knew that that these thoughts and these fears and these sensations were not normal. So these weren't, kind of classic hallucinations, if you will. And then that was, the story sort of built from there. And the fears and the intrusive thoughts would change in content, and the themes had a certain, consistency to them, in the sense that a lot of them were very, alarming and terrifying. But I knew intuitively that they weren't quote unquote real. Mm-hmm. And that was the beginning of my journey into trying to figure this particular area out. And I never once, drew a connection between this and at the time, even between the strep or the psoriasis or anything. That didn't happen until, 30 years later.
You know, it's worth pointing out here too, just quickly, that, a lot of times when people who are not familiar with OCD hear about OCD, hand washing and contamination fears kind of are sort of the main thing that people recognize as the component of obsessive compulsive disorder, or that define obsessive compulsive disorder. But the intrusive recurrent thoughts that harm may come to you, or that you may accidentally harm yourself, or that you're going to harm someone else, are incredibly prevalent symptoms in OCD too, that sometimes go unrecognized as actually a symptom of OCD. These intrusive thoughts are, when you break down kind of the prevalence of symptoms of both pediatric and adult OCD, these intrusive thoughts of self-harm or harm to others and worry about doing something like that, they're nearly as prominent as kind of germ fears, sickness fears, washing. So they're really a core, very common component of OCD that sometimes doesn't sort of get recognized as classical OCD, but it's certainly a part of it.
Yeah, and it's certainly at the time, well, my sort of ritualistic or compulsive response to these thoughts was to do research. And this was before the internet. So I was in bookstores or in libraries reading through whatever material I could find on the subject, and which actually managed to add fuel to the fire in many cases. But that was kind of, and that wasn't a visible, act per se. And at the time I believed that the purely obsessional, OCD wasn't as well known. And I don't think OCD was, I think it was still pretty peripheral at the time. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, I would say it's just the recognition, the treatment, and the appreciation of how common a condition that it is, both in kids and adults, really. If we put it at the 1990s and following, I think that that's kind of when it considered as something that happens as often as it does.
So, Dr. Williams, do you have any thoughts on the olfactory sensations that Andrew had?
I don't.
Smelling the fresh grass.
It's interesting. Yeah, I don't. It's interesting. I don't. Other than it happens, but I don't know that I can place it in relation to some of the other things we're talking about, as far as either infection or I wouldn't say that it's necessarily a common feature that I see in people with OCD, but that that doesn't mean much either, as far as sometimes uncommon things happen. And but there's not a clue or a different part of that portion that I think comes to mind.
Okay. So thanks for that. Andrew, so you left top college here in New England, left college in your freshman year?
I did. Yeah, I went from pretty rapidly from being, at the top percentile of my class to the very bottom. I couldn't read. I would get to the bottom of a page and I'd have this fear that I hadn't read everything, so I'd start at the top again. I wasn't able to study. I was very completely distracted by this experience. And I did make my way to the infirmary, which led me to seeing a psychologist and then a psychiatrist.
And they started you off on a pretty strong drug, if I recall correctly.
Yep. It was being, sort of the initial diagnosis was an acute psychotic episode. And I was placed on Haldol, which I thought that had stopped happening in the 50s or 60s, but it didn't really do anything. But that kind of gives you a taste of the, you know, the beginning of that part of the journey, and trying to, you know, I found myself trying to navigate, you know, trying to explain my experience, and also, you know, advocate for myself and explain, you know, the, unfortunately, the treatment really wasn't, you know, didn't have really any impact. And that's tricky business when, you know, and I definitely wound up in a circumstance where it just led to additional, you know, pharmacology.
So you come from a family of physicians, and yes. Yeah, for the next 33 years, you still had a difficult time navigating the system to establish some adequate treatment, correct?
Correct. I mean, we exhausted a lot of resources. You know, it was really difficult on my family because I wasn't getting better, and there was a lot of head scratching.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't fit neatly into any particular category, and because the treatment wasn't working, that just kind of compounded things.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, that was one of the really challenging parts of this, was that you know, because I didn't get better, and because it was kind of nebulous, that I fell into this kind of peripheral category. And you know, after nearly a decade of trying to find, you know, some sort of solution, that I just got to a point where I had to really, you know, dissociate as best I could and put this into a compartment so I could function. Because I was, you know, I was definitely staring down a life that was not one that I wanted.
No.
And so I kind of took the position of well, do the best you can what you currently have. And I was able to, you know, still able to function and compensate for this. So that's the route I took. But it didn't stop me from trying to find a solution. That was definitely my part-time, if not sometimes full-time job, when I wasn't, you know, taking care of myself.
And I think you joked with me that maybe that was one of the benefits of OCD, that you weren't going to stop looking for a solution.
Yeah, that was one of the conundrums or paradoxes that there's an element of it, of the, you know, there's a certain perfectionism, that there were times when I didn't feel comfortable. I couldn't complete a task because it didn't feel right. And the diagnoses and the treatments didn't feel right. So I wasn't sure if it was like, okay, is this part of the disorder, or is this actually, you know, reality? You know, my gut told me that it isn't, it's not the right fit. This isn't, you know, the right diagnosis or treatment.
So, Dr. Williams, the idea of pandas wouldn't come along until Dr. Sue Sweeto's paper in 1998. And yet there's a long history of the role of infection triggering psychiatric symptoms. Why, any ideas about why the psychiatrists and neurologists, psychologists, all the physicians who Andrew saw didn't think about the role of strep and the role that might have played? I want to get into your research in just a minute,
yeah.
But it just seems like a philosophical question. It baffles me.
Probably the thing that comes to mind first, and Andrew, you can answer this for us, but they probably never asked. I doubt, I mean, maybe, and I'm not trying to disparage, you know, other docs or, you know, mm-hmm. but psychiatry, I think to the detriment of psychiatry and medicine, has been sort of set apart from most other forms of medicine for its beginning, in a sense, you know, and during the kind of intake and discussion with patient when they're coming in for the first time, unless it's something that someone really prominently brings up, there's usually not a great deal of diving into someone's medical history. And I mean, there should and could be, but I think that it's hard to draw associations between those things if, you know, you don't have the previous knowledge of knowing that there could be an association there. And then you're not asking those questions. So it kind of creates this, I think, negative feedback loop for a long time, where it was sort of like we were not asking patients about other medical conditions, other infections, other things that were happening. And so it just didn't become part of what we consider to be associated with the onset of cancer conditions and cancer diseases. And sometimes it's not associated with those things, right? You know, sometimes it is not due to a medical illness or an infectious illness. Or, you know, so there are, I don't want to make it sound like these things are always linked in a sort of mechanistic way, but still it's worth asking the questions to figure out, start to hear some things about what makes things worse, what makes things better. And, you know, if infections or other inflammatory conditions are playing a role in someone's depression or some other thing is worsening, then it's worth knowing that. It's worth asking and trying to plan and create a treatment for that considers all those different aspects too.
So thank you for that. And I'd like to come back to that subject at the end if we have time. But what I'd really like to hear now is what your ideas about how to research this subject. As some of you may know who are listening, the Alex Manfel Fund is supporting the research that Kyle will be doing in the broad area of OCD, IL-17, and Cosentyx, and psoriasis. I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about what you're going to do. And
yeah, I think it's worth backing up to kind of getting the email from Andrew first, because it's not, I don't want to down, I mean, I think it's worth talking about what a pivotal, you know, occurrence that was, because when there are infections, certain kinds of infections, streptococcal infection, certainly, there's a cascade of different immune factors that play a role. There are certain cells that are specifically involved, and then those cells produce messengers, right? So chemical messengers. And those chemical messenger systems sometimes are, you know, or not sometimes, they are very much a part of your body fighting off the infection. And so inflammation in this sense, I know we talk about inflammation as it being a negative thing a lot, but it's really a crucial part of your body's defense against fighting a strep infection. So your immune system needs to generate inflammation to counteract a bacterial or a viral infection. And then there are times when those signals become dysregulated, overactive, last for longer than they should. Sometimes the bacterial infection can initiate a cascade of these inflammatory factors that end up actually doing more harm than they were intended to. So it's not just clearing the infection, but it sort of does some organ damage as well. And there was a lot of discussion about with COVID, about the sort of the cytokine storm. And so it's not, again, it's not that these things are not component of normal daily life and immune function. They are. It's just that they are now overstimulated, or in some people who may have a genetic predisposition to inflammatory or autoimmune illness, they're acting in a dysregulated way, and maybe the brakes on the car no longer work in a sense. And it is basically kind of the cytokine production is going out of control, or there's some other product that can't be stopped after it's sort of initiated. And IL-17 is a component of IL-17 is a cytokine, a group of a family of cytokines that is produced in response to bacterial infections, and primarily by a T cell, a type of T cell called Th17 cell. So Th17 cells produce IL-17, and they do so in response to certain infections. And what's been recognized over the past decade plus is that IL-17 and potentially the Th17 cells are also involved in a number of autoimmune or inflammatory disorders too. So psoriasis certainly is a major one. Other conditions called ankylosing spondylitis and some other types of autoimmune condition are also at some level have dysregulation of this IL-17 cytokines as a component of the condition. And when Andrew emailed about psoriasis and Cosentyx and OCD, then not only, you know, had there been some previous research that was being done at Columbia from Jutan Agalio and then someone else, Patrick Cleary, who I knew from medical school, they were looking at animal models of strep infection. So they were actually generating a strep infection in mice, which mice are not normally susceptible to getting strep. Strep is actually unique in the bacterial world in that it's primarily or solely a pathogen of humans. It doesn't have like an animal reservoir that it can sort of move between. And so mice don't normally get strep. So they've kind of created a way to model a strep infection in mice. And in doing so, they noticed that actually that the induction of these Th17 cells was very strong, and that these Th17 cells actually migrated into the brain and started producing inflammatory cytokines resident in the brain in the mice after they were giving them strep infection. So there is that kind of that a piece of that link that was known at the time between strep and potentially, you know, brain resident inflammatory production of Th17 and IL-17 production. But what I really wanted to look at after Andrew emailed was, is there also a known association between specifically psoriasis or some of these other conditions and OCD? And there are a number of researchers that have utilized these registries, particularly the Danish registry and the Scandinavian registry system, where you can anonymously look at an entire population. And this is only researchers who are allowed to do this, right? It's very specifically regulated. But with approval, they're able to look at things like, if you have obsessive compulsive disorder, are you more likely to have psoriasis? Are you more likely to have Sjogren's? Are you more likely to have lupus? And you can build a table of whether or not these conditions are co-occurring and whether they're co-occurring at different rates with different conditions. Like, if you have OCD, are you more likely to have psoriasis? But if you have autism, are you more likely to have a different type of autoimmune condition or things like that? And there have been a number of groups, David Matai-Schulz group at Karolinska, and then some groups in Taiwan too, who have looked at these different autoimmune conditions in adults with OCD and tic disorder, and found that actually that autoimmune skin condition and psoriasis, and this is more from the group in Taiwan, found that there is a real association between psoriasis or inflammatory skin conditions and obsessive compulsive disorder. It's actually, you know, you are more likely to have some of these conditions if you have OCD. People with psoriasis have a number of other, you know, it's not specifically OCD that is only elevated in psoriasis. People with psoriasis also suffer from a number of other kind of, you know, depression and other anxiety conditions too. But when you look at the number or the frequency of different autoimmune conditions in those that have OCD, it seems like it's huge in certain ways. And psoriasis is one of sort of the mainly, you know, most represented autoimmune condition.
So can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
There's a clear history in my family of psoriasis.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it goes back several generations through my maternal line. Is it possible that if there is that genetic predisposition to have some, you know, dysregulation of IL-17, that makes you susceptible to strep?
You know, it might. The IL-17 and Th17 cells are in this really unique role in the immune system where there's a balance between a type of T cell called a T regulatory cell and Th17 cells. It's almost like as one goes up, the other goes down. And T regulatory cells are a type of T cell that actually suppress and control sort of autoimmune components. Because originally the thinking when autoimmunity was that the people that have autoimmune diseases because these self-reactive sort of cells were not deleted out from the body in the way that they should have been. But they're actually, these T cells go through this, what they call it, you know, education process, where the cells that are reactive, self-reactive, should be basically, you know, deleted. And one of the thoughts was that the people that have autoimmune conditions are those that fail to delete those T cells coming out. And what's more widely recognized now is that we all probably have some of those kind of self-reactive cells in our body. So it's not, the deletion is not 100% or perfect in any of us. It's just that you also have other means of keeping those self-reactive, kind of those auto-reactive cells under wraps. You have regulatory mechanisms to keep them from going out of control. And T regulatory cells are one cell that may be active in that process. And because they exist almost in the seesaw at times with Th17 cells, in the course of infection, it's possible that the shift actually shifts people into more of an autoimmune kind of realm, if that makes sense.
So is there a threshold? So in other words, like, you know, I clearly had inflammatory disease for years. You can see, mm-hmm. you know, I had lymph nodes that were constantly swollen, plaque psoriasis, pitted nails, the whole bit. And so is it possible that when you get to a certain level of, you know, inflammatory disease, that it kind of flips you over into the state where it's just, unless there's some sort of intervention, that you're going to stay in that sort of immunological state?
Yeah.
Really?
Well, in the sense that people with certain types of autoimmune conditions, it does not self-resolve.
Right.
Because if you consider it from sort of the immune system's perspective, it is not drawing a distinction that it should between self-reactive or foreign kind of bacteria at that point.
Right.
And so if it continues to see a target, but the target is your own cell, it will continue to react to that because there's nothing telling it that it's lost the ability to differentiate between self and other. And so it keeps sort of being stimulated to produce an inflammatory response because it keeps seeing your own proteins, your own, if it was skin or joint or things like that, then.
Yeah. And from its own perspective, it's kind of doing its job.
Yeah. And it very likely in that sense too, because I think the other thing too that's worth mentioning is that the immune system in people with autoimmune conditions is not strong. It's not that it suffers from being too strong and attacks everything. It's dysregulated in the sense that it is attacking one thing very likely at the exclusion of providing immunity from bacterial infections or other things. So you can have an inflammatory condition of a very stimulated immune state, but also be susceptible to infection on the other at the same time, because your immune system is actually prioritizing and putting too much effort into sort of a dysregulated response, and it doesn't have the ability to sort of actually regulate the typical things that it would do, like fight an infection. The reason I'm coming back to this is that the question of, you were saying, can I have a genetic predisposition to an inflammatory or immune psoriasis state or another condition, but also be more susceptible to infection? It's probably yes, because the inflammatory state doesn't necessarily mean that your immune system is helping to work out or to protect you from infection. It's probably the opposite. It's actually making you more likely to have infection.
Wow. That's incredibly interesting. Kyle, can you talk about where Cosentyx fits in here?
Yeah. Just to come back to that story too, of kind of getting Andrew's email and then seeing, okay, so we know that from Jutan's work that and from others too, that strep infections are, you know, can induce and stimulate the Th17 response. So the strep, the Th17, we are very interested in strep and OCD. And then here's this other line of research that says, hey, there's a correlation between psoriasis and OCD. You know, so we've kind of had it on a number of different levels that there's something here. And then Andrew's story really was sort of like this linking piece of like, oh, by the way, I took a drug that the only thing that this drug does is to reduce IL-17, and my OCD got better, right? And my psoriasis got better. But it's sort of the kind of ties together this entire, you know, these other lines of from epidemiology to kind of the basic science research that there may be something to this that is actually a mechanism, right? That IL-17 is involved in some way. And I'm not trying to make it sound overly simplistic to say that IL-17 is the cause of OCD symptoms in, you know, you, Andrew, or in others, but that there was some activity like that modulating this pathway of IL-17 had a benefit on OCD symptoms. And that is borne out by Andrew's story, but then also the research is suggesting that there could be some link between these things too.
But what will your research be to cast light on this relationship?
So a lot of people are receiving Cosentyx or similar medications now too. So Cosentyx is not the only medication in this pathway that affect, you know, so Cosentyx is one example of a medication where it's called a monoclonal antibody. So it is basically the medication itself is an antibody. The antibody is against IL-17A. And so the antibody binds inflammatory cytokine and then, you know, removes it from the system. And so you get an overall reduction of your IL-17 levels, and then, you know, your psoriasis improves, things like that. So a lot of people are getting these medications now for psoriasis, psoriatic arthritis, other autoimmune conditions. And we know from the epidemiological research that probably there's a good percentage of them that have OCD or have maybe depression or another kind of behavioral psychiatric condition too. So what we'd like to do is to do first to find out, I think my inclination and bias is definitely that, you know, Andrew, your story is really informative, and you can't be the only one who's had this experience before. There have to be other people, right?
Yeah.
And just then by nature, the fact that, again, that a lot of people with psoriasis also may have OCD, there have to be other people who have had some, maybe not the response that you did, but if we don't find out and ask, we're not going to know. And so the first part of this research is trying to find people who have OCD, who have already taken one of these IL-17 or IL-23 medications, and just first to understand the stories to see if this is replicated in the same way that Andrew's experience has been. And then the second part of the research is to prospectively look at people who are in clinics for either psoriasis or psoriatic arthritis who maybe have tried other treatments. Like, you know, Andrew, your story about I tried a lot of things, and then I got to the point where I developed psoriatic arthritis, and that's when they put me on this medication. There are a lot of other people who are very likely in kind of that sort of pipeline, in a sense of, yeah, we're trying these other things first, but then we're going to move to Cosentyx or another monoclonal antibody treatment because, you know, this condition has arisen, or, you know, it's turned into psoriatic arthritis. We would like to try to find those folks who are going to be placed on but haven't yet been placed on these medications, who also have OCD, and try to track over time, is there an improvement? And
So in my situation, so I viewed the psoriasis as a skin condition for the longest time. I never, you know, perceived of it as an autoimmune issue. And so when that became the conversation that, no, this is psoriatic arthritis, and here you go, here's the medication that is, I mean, it is laser focused on IL-17. It's very clear in the documentation that comes with the medication, as well as all the science behind it. That, that was a startling event for me. And then, you know, as I've said a number of times already, that the relief was dramatic and very rapid. The question I have is, I mean, the link in my eyes is between, you know, psoriatic arthritis and IL-17 is pretty clear, right?
Yes.
So are there these kissing cousins between, you know, because there's a blood-brain barrier in between, that there isn't a direct sort of mechanism within the brain in the same fashion, that there is something that's indirect, like that's the inflammation that might be causing these issues, as opposed to, like, you know, an immune mobilization in the same way that, you know, that psoriasis is, that your body is basically, you know, attacking itself. Does that make sense?
It does. I mean, it's, so the blood-brain barrier is designed to keep a number of immune cells out, and a number of immune factors, you know, like cytokines, typically are meant to be excluded from the brain by the blood-brain barrier. But you do have a resident number. You have, the brain has its own immune system, in a sense. It has its own immune cells that are similar to other types of immune cells that are outside the body. And so these are called microglia, and they're similar to a type of cell called macrophages that are sort of a real workhorse of the immune system outside the body. But microglia are brain resident. They're there all the time, and they perform a number of really critical functions that have nothing to do with the immune system, but then they can become inflamed, activated, and produce inflammatory factors in response to either a brain infection or in response to degeneration or traumatic brain injury or stroke or things like that too. And what is interesting about that cell also in obsessive compulsive disorder is that there, you know, in the early 2000s, there was a group at the University of Utah, they were knocking certain genes out of mice. Basically, they're you know, saying, if we remove this gene from the mouse, how does the mouse develop? And, you know, what does this gene do? And we'll answer the question of deleting it from the genome. And they deleted this gene, the HOXB8 gene. And the mice developed normally, except for the fact that they groomed all of the hair off of themselves. They groomed basically continuously in a way that was very problematic, very striking, and created lesion on the mice too. And for a long time, this group, they were struggling, or not struggling, I mean, they were trying to find out, what do we actually do by deleting this gene? Because the brain looks like it developed normally, everything, you know, anatomically looks like it's in place. And what they figured out was that they deleted the production of microglia, of a certain type of microglia from the brain. So they actually removed this immune cell from the mice, and the mice responded with this behavior that is akin to obsessive compulsive disorder. Mm. And then they were actually able to give the mice back. They gave them a bone marrow transplant to allow them to create that cell again. So they gave them a bone marrow transplant with normal bone marrow that had this gene back in it. And the microglia migrated to the brain, and the mice stopped the OCD behavior. So this was one of the first demonstrations that sort of manipulation of the brain's internal immune system seemed like it had some role in some kind of compulsive behavior in animals. It's not fair to call, you know, this grooming behavior like animal OCD, but it's an accepted sort of model system for setting OCD in mice. And so fast forward basically to, you know, a number of years later, where a group in Toronto looked at, okay, if we have this animal literature that says that microglia are maybe involved in OCD, can we look at microglia in humans? And there's a type of imaging called a PET study. It's a positron emission tomography study where you can actually create a tracer that's specific to a cell. And there's a number of tracers that are specific to microglia that we use in research, but we don't use in clinical medicine. And so they looked at, are the microglia in adults with obsessive compulsive disorder either overactive, or are they, you know, are they too numerous compared to people without OCD? And they found that in all of the brain regions that are really key components of OCD, microglia were overrepresented. They were overactive. They were radically different in sort of the energy and the uptake of this microglial signal. It was very different in those with OCD compared to normal. So there, again, is kind of more evidence that this immune cell in the brain potentially is involved in OCD. And it's not a huge surprise then to learn that microglia actually, you know, are responsive to IL-17. You know, they because they're an immune cell, and because IL-17 is an inflammatory chemical messenger for immune cells, then they have stimulated response to IL-17 and can take on an inflammatory phenotype in response to IL-17 too. So I don't mean to make this sound like this is in any way the known pathway or sort of settled science about how this is occurring, how IL-17 may be sort of bridging these different things. But there's a very plausible mechanism for how inflammatory messengers are uptaken by the brain and or the cells that they would interact with. And those cells have also been shown to at least be involved in mouse models of OCD and also shown to be abnormal in adults with humans with OCD.
So Kyle, is this positron emission tomography, microglia research, what you're doing with adult PANDAS PANS patients?
With adults with OCD, yeah. So we are following up on that. So that study originally was done at the University of Toronto. And so we are replicating that or attempting to replicate that with a different additional suite of imaging tools also. So we're doing a combination of PET imaging plus MRI imaging in adults with OCD. And we can't do this imaging in kids for research because it involves radiation. We don't expose kids to radiation for research purposes, full stop. But in adults, it is a small dose of radiation, that adults can make a choice to sort of participate in this research to help our understanding of OCD. And that's what we're doing now, is to try to see, can we get more of an answer of how microglia are different in adults with OCD.
Wow.
We're still not doing grown-up PANDAS patient, but it's adults with OCD, but an extension of this, and we had started that work prior to us being in contact, but it would really be interesting to see as an extension of that. On some level, Andrew, I think your experience and your story is a subtype of OCD, right? It's not the general sort of IL-17 for some people may be very involved in their OCD symptoms, but writ large, it may not be the core component of everyone's sort of the reason why people have OCD. And so you can imagine an imaging study that would be restricted to people with co-occurring OCD and psoriasis to see are their microglia, are their brain immune systems even more or especially sort of affected compared to healthy controls or adults with OCD without any sort of autoimmune or inflammatory conditions too.
So there could be there are other potential pathways to the same.
I think there have to be, yeah.
Yeah.
Just like, when we look at, we know autism is probably, Lord knows how many hundreds of different conditions. We call it autism because it at times looks, the behaviors look similar, but the pathways to get there are very different. And that's because, a number of different things could be involved. And for obsessive compulsive disorder, and I think this is true for PANDAS as well, there are probably a number of different ways to get there. There are certain genes that are involved with it. There are other environmental factors that are involved. And because of that, there are going to be people where the treatment response is likely going to be different. And I think that by extension, we should say too that this conversation today is not meant to have people say, I want to use cosentics to treat my OCD because we're not there. And people listening to this could say, like, why are you doing this other research instead of just doing a trial of cosentics for OCD right now? And the answer to that is that we're just really not sure. One, cosentics, while, being widely used and very helpful for a number of conditions, there's still a lot of important consideration, right, in using a medication that is affecting the immune system. So we want to make sure that it would be warranted and safe. And then also that we have some a priori idea of who it actually would be helpful for, that we wouldn't just sort of blanket treatment everybody with OCD with something like Cosentyx, but we would try to find people that we think are going to be more likely to respond to it.
Kyle, you mentioned IL-23, and we know mm-hmm. that they're biologics for psoriasis that target IL-23. I think you're going to look at some of those as well. Can you just talk yep. about what is IL-23 and do you think that will be relevant to OCD? Or
I think the first answer I would say is we'll find out, or we'll, if we look, we'll hopefully get some information on that. IL-23 it's closely tied to IL-17 function because IL-23 stimulates Th17 cells to produce IL-17. So it's sort of another on-ramp in this pathway to affect IL-17 function is to is to affect IL-23 levels. And so that's why there's some medications for psoriasis that affect, that are monoclonal antibodies against IL-23, and then there's some that are against IL-17. And then there are even some against another very important and prominent immune component and cytokine called TNF-alpha. And there are other monoclonal antibodies that affect those pathways too. So there is a possibility, you know, depending on the number of people that we can look at to see if we're actually have the statistical power to do this, but we can look at do medications that affect the IL-17, IL-23 pathway. Do those seem like they're actually more effective for OCD symptoms compared to those who are treated with TNF-alpha medication? Mm-hmm. And that would help to, you know, that would help to kind of hone in more on it's this specific component potentially of the immune system and not sort of inflammation in general, but it's sort of this is the targeted aspect that seems like it's more important in OCD.
As I mentioned to you, Susan, I it was a lottery ticket when my psoriasis became psoriatic arthritis, and I was literally in the doctor's office for 15 minutes before I was onboarded with Cosentyx. And that's, you know, that's after decades of being, you know, my own lobbyist in other offices, trying to access the proper treatment for me. And, you know, I don't fault medicine and its structure for it. You know, there's standards of care that have to be inherently conservative. But yeah, the front end of being properly diagnosed, you know, when you don't fit into a specific, discrete, you know, set of criterion, I think that's one of the challenges. And, mm-hmm. you know, if we can solve for that and make sure that you get on the right pathway, I think that's, you know, very important, that the presumption is that there's a treatment pathway to back up that decision. And there's so many more today than there was when I was, you know, 17. And, you know, and I'm extremely grateful for the work that Dr. Williams is doing. And of course, what you're doing as well, Susan, it keeps this thing moving forward. And it works. It doesn't always work as fast as we would like. And but I feel like I participated in the circumstance in my own way to help things along.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Thank you so much for sharing your story. I think it will be instrumental in opening the eyes of many people. And Kyle, thank you so much for all the research that you do and all the conversations that you have with me to help me understand this field that's still pretty new to me.
Well, thank you for bringing everybody together in a way that creates this forum and the ability for people to learn and us to move these things forward too.
It's really been an extraordinary conversation. Thank you. And I'm just going to end by saying something that you said earlier, Kyle, just to make sure that people understand that this is really very preliminary research. So please don't run out to your doctor and ask for a prescription of Cosentyx. It's way too early for that. Dr. Williams is doing this research and we'll find out more. But if you do have a diagnosis of psoriasis or OCD, and especially if you're taking Cosentyx or another biologic, please write to Dr. Williams, and his email address, I'll tell you right now, but I'll also have that in the written part of the podcast. And it is Dr. Williams with no period. So just Dr. Williams, Dr. Williams at drkylewilliams.com. If you have a story to tell him. Okay. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For more information about Pandas and Pans and the Alex Manful Fund, please listen to the following 1-minute public service announcement and visit thealexmanfulfund.org.
Hello, my name is Terry Downing. My daughter Tessa waited far too long, 13 years ago, to be diagnosed and treated when she began to suffer from a disease called PANS PANDAS. PANDAS stands for Pediatric Autoimmune Neuropsychiatric Disorders Associated with Strep Infections. Yes, strep throat. Tessa is forever damaged because of her delayed diagnosis. But there is hope, and she is a hero in my eyes.
The Alex Manful Fund is an organization created by two parents who lost their daughter Alex to PANDAS. Countless doctors failed to recognize Alex's condition in the 7 years after her obsessions and compulsions began following a bout of strep. Early diagnosis and treatment saves lives, so they created the Alex Manful Fund. The fund supports important research like the Georgetown Brain Bank and education about PANDAS and PANS. Parents have begun to recognize PANDAS in their children and are accessing an accurate diagnosis and treatment more and more. To learn more about PANDAS and PANS, please visit www.thealexmanfulfund.org.
The content in this podcast is not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition.